Mom told me that. Once my dad was beating on me, we was in the garage, so I grabbed up a hammer.
Ork now pantomimed the scene, grabbing the hammer, looking at it, raising it. Then he let it drop.
She said, "You kill your father, you'll burn in hell."
What happened then?
Ork held up his left hand. He pushed it close to Howard's face. There was a scar, almost perfectly round, no more than a quarter inch across.
"What's that?"
Howard asked.
"Power drill. 3/16 bit."
Ork laughed ruefully.
"Guess I'm lucky it wasn't the 3/4 inch, huh?"
"That's messed up, man,"
Howard said. He'd always known that Ork came from a tough home, but a power drill was off the hook. He himself came from a fairly average home. Neither of his parents was a drunk or violent or anything. Howard did what he had to do to survive, being small and weak and not popular. He liked being in charge, having people scared of him, so being Ork's friend had worked out for him. But now Howard was starting to see that, though Ork was stupid, he wasn't wrong. Ork and School Bus Sam, the big hero, were never going to get along. And now, Howard was as trapped as Ork. Trapped.
"Okay, then," Howard said. "We go to Kane."
Ork belched loudly.
"Kane's mad at us."
"Yeah," Howard said. "But he still needs us."
36. 84 hours, 41 minutes.
"Hold him down!"
Diana yelled. The sound of her voice was far off. Drake Merwin heard it bubbling up through a red scream that filled his brain. Screaming, screaming, screaming everywhere, all through his brain, from a million mouths, rising and falling, gasping for breath.
"I can hold him," a voice said.
Kane.
"Back away on three. One, two."
Drake flailed madly, unbound, shrieking, thrashing, hurting himself but unable to stop. The pain. He had never felt anything like it, never imagined anything could be like it. A force pressed down on him like a thousand hands holding him with firm pressure.
"You have the saw?"
Diana's voice asked. Not smug now, not smug at all, but raw and horrified. Drake struggled against the invisible force, but Kane had him pinned down with his telekinetic power. Drake could only scream and curse, and could barely move his facial muscles enough for that.
"I am not doing this,"
Panda said, weeping.
"I'm not sawing off his arm, man."
The words sent a shock of terror to join the pain. His arm? They were...
"He'll kill me if I do it,"
Panda said.
"I'm not doing it,"
various voices chimed in.
"No way. I'll do it,"
Diana said, disgusted.
"You're all such big, tough guys. Give me the saw."
"No, no, no!"
Drake screeched. "It's the only way to stop the pain," Kane said, almost showing some emotion, some pity. "The arm is done for, Drake man."
"The girl! The freak!"
Drake gasped.
"She can fix it!"
"She's not here," Kane said bitterly. "She's gone with Sam and the rest of them."
"Don't cut off my arm!"
Drake cried.
"Let me die! Just let me die! Shoot me!"
"Sorry," Kane said, "but I still need you, Drake." even one-handed. There was the sound of someone bursting into the room.
All I could find was Tylenol and Advil, Computer Jack said. Let's get this over with,
Diana snapped. Impatient to maim him, looking forward to it.
You do this, he's gonna kill you,
Panda warned.
Oh, Drake's already decided he wants to do that,
Diana said.
Tighten the tourniquet. He's going to bleed to death,
Jack warned.
There must be big arteries in his arm.
He's right, Kane said. We need a way to seal the stump.
It's already cauterized, Diana said. I just need to cut below the burn.
Yeah, okay, Kane agreed.
I can't reach him through your force field, Diana said. Can you pull it back to keep his left side paralyzed? And maybe Panda and some of these other supposedly tough guys can grab onto his stump.
Let me get a towel, at least. I don't want to touch that,
Panda said with revulsion.
Nobody cuts my arm,
Drake rasped.
I'll kill anyone who touches me.
Let him up, Kane,
Diana snapped. The elephant was off Drake's chest. He could move again. But now Diana's face was inches from his, her dark hair hanging down on his tear-streaked face.
Listen, you stupid thug, Diana said. We're cutting off the pain. As long as that burned stump is there, you'll be like this. You'll be screaming and crying and wetting your pants. Yeah, you've peed yourself, Drake.
Somehow, that fact shocked Drake into silence.
You have one hope, just one, that we cut off the dead part of your arm and do it without starting the bleeding again.
Anyone cuts me dies, Drake said.
Diana pulled back, out of Drake's view. Kane said,
do it.
Panda, Chunk, grab that stump. The pressure was on Drake again, immobilizing him. He didn't feel the towel that was wrapped around his arm, or the grip of hands. That part of his arm was naked bone, all flesh melted away, nerves burned off, dead. The pain started higher up, where just enough nerve endings still survived to slam his fevered brain with wave upon wave of agony.
It's not Diana, or Panda, or Chunk, or even me. Kane said, it's none of us, Drake. It's Sam. It's Sam who did this to you, Drake. You want him to get away with it? Or do you want to live long enough to make him suffer?
Drake heard a shimmery, metallic sound. The saw was too big for Diana to handle easily. The blade wobbled a little as she lined it up.
Okay, Diana said. Hold on to him. I'll be as quick as I can be.
Drake lost consciousness, but his dreams were as pain-racked as his waking. He weaved in and out, awake and screaming, asleep and crying. He heard a distant thump as his arm dropped to the floor. And then, a sudden frenzy of running and yelling, shouting orders in confusion, a flash of Diana threading a needle with bloody fingers. Hands all over him, the pressure squeezing the air from his lungs. Staring up from the bottom of a deep well, Drake saw lunatic faces looking down at him. Eyes wild, bloody faces like monsters.
He'll live, I think,
a voice said.
God help us if he lives,
a voice said.
No, God help Sam Temple.
And then, nothing. Astrid, I need you to start talking to these kids, Sam said. Find out their powers. Find out how much control they have. We're looking for anyone who might be able to help in a fight. Astrid looked uncomfortable.
Me? Shouldn't Adelio be doing that?
I have a different job for Adelio. They were in the plaza, sitting wearily on the steps of Town Hall, Sam, Astrid, Little Pete, and Adelio. Quinn was gone. No one knew where. The liberated Coates kids, the Coates freaks, as they now proudly called themselves, had been fed at Ralph's and were being fed again by Albert, who was walking among them handing out burgers. Some of the kids had eaten too much all at once and had thrown up, but most still had room for a hamburger, even if it was on a toasted chocolate chip waffle. Lana was just about finished healing the hands of the refugees. She was staggering from exhaustion, and finally, as Sam watched, her legs folded under her, and she fell to the grass. Before he could even get up to help, some of the Coates kids stretched her out with gentleness bordering on reverence. They rolled jackets to make her a pillow, and borrowed a blanket from a tattered pup tent to spread over her.
"Okay, I'll talk to them,"
Astrid said, but she still looked reluctant.
"I can't read people like Diana does."
"That's what's bothering you? You're not my Diana, and hopefully I'm not Cain."
"I guess I was hoping this would all kind of be over, at least for a while."
"I think it will be over, for a while. But first we have to plan and make sure we're ready when Cain comes back."
"You're right."
She smiled wanly.
"Anyway, it's not like I was dreaming of a big meal, a hot shower, and hours of sleep."
"Yeah. You wouldn't want to start getting soft now, would you?" Something else occurred to him. "But hey, keep LP happy, huh? I don't want you disappearing suddenly."
"That would be a shame, wouldn't it?"
she said dryly.
"Maybe I'll try Quinn's trick. Hawaii, Petey. Hawaii."
Astrid rounded up her brother, made sure he was okay, then plunged into the crowd. Sam motioned Adelio closer.
"Adelio, I have something I need you to do."
"Whatever you want."
"It involves driving. And it involves keeping a secret."
"The secret is no problem. Driving?"
He gulped theatrically, like a cartoon character doing a double take.
"I need you to get a truck and go to the power plant."
He explained what he wanted, and Adelio's expression grew darker with each word. When he was done, Sam asked, "Can you handle that? You'll need to take at least one other guy with you."
"I can do it," Adelio said. "I'm not happy about it, but you know that."
"Who will you take with you?"
"Elwood, I guess, if Dara will let me borrow him."
"Okay. Go take an hour or two to figure out how to drive."
"A day or two, more like it,"
Adelio said. But then he executed a mock salute and said,
"No problem, General."
Sam sat alone now, shoulders hunched, head buzzing from lack of sleep and the after effects of pain and fear. He needed to think, he told himself. Needed to prepare. Cain would be planning. Cain. His brother.
His brother.
How long did he have?
3 days.
In 3 days, he would disappear. And so would Cain. Maybe die. Maybe be changed in some way. Maybe just pop neatly back into the old universe with lots of incredible stories to tell. And leave Astrid behind. If Cain had been a normal, well-adjusted person, he might spend his last days preparing for whatever the poof meant. Death, disappearance, escape. But Sam doubted Cain would do that. Cain would need to triumph over Sam. that need would be even greater than the need to be ready for the end.
I never have liked birthdays,
Sam muttered. Albert Hillsborough had finished handing out burgers to grateful Coates kids. He climbed the steps to Sam.
Glad you're back, man,
Albert said. For some reason, Sam felt compelled to stand and offer his hand to the kid. Albert shook it solemnly.
It's cool what you've done, keeping the Mickey D's open.
Albert looked faintly annoyed.
We don't call it Mickey D's. It's McDonald's. It will always be McDonald's. Although, he allowed, I've strayed pretty far from the standard operating manual.
I saw the waffle burgers. There was something on Albert's mind. Whatever it was, Sam didn't have the time or the energy, but Albert was becoming an important person, someone not to blow off.
What's up, Albert?
Well, I've done inventory at Ralph's, and I think if I had a lot of help, I could put together an okay Thanksgiving dinner.
Sam stared at him. He blinked.
What?
Thanksgiving. It's next week.
Uh-huh.
There are ovens at Ralph's, big ones, and no one has taken the frozen turkeys. Figure 250 kids if pretty much everyone from Perdido Beach shows up, right? One turkey will feed maybe 8 people, so we need 32 turkeys. No problem there because there are 46 turkeys at Ralph's.
31 turkeys?
Cranberry sauce will be no problem. Stuffing is no problem. No one has taken much stuffing yet, although I'll have to figure out how to mix, like, 7 different brands and styles together, see how it tastes.
Stuffing, Sam echoed solemnly.
We don't have enough canned yams. We'll have to do fresh, along with some baked potatoes. The big problem is going to be whipped cream and ice cream for the pies.
Sam wanted to burst out laughing, but at the same time, he found it touching and reassuring that Albert had put so much thought into the question.
I imagine the ice cream is pretty much gone, Sam said.
Yeah, we're very low on ice cream. And kids have been taking the canned whipped cream, too.
But we can have pie?
We have some frozen, and we have some pie shells we can bake up ourselves.
That would be nice, Sam said.
I'll need to start 3 days before. I'll need, like, at least 10 people to help. I can haul the tables out of the church basement and set up in the plaza. I think I can do it.
I'll bet you can, Albert, Sam said with feeling.
Mother Mary's gonna have the prees make centerpieces.
Listen, Albert...
Albert raised a hand, cutting Sam off.
I know. I mean, I know we may have some great big fight before that. And I heard you have your 15th coming up. All kinds of bad stuff may happen. But Sam...
This time, Sam cut him off.
Albert, get moving on planning the big meal.
Yeah?
Yeah. It will give people something to look forward to.
Albert left, and Sam fought down a yawn. He noticed Astrid deep in conversation with 3 of the Coates kids. Astrid had been through all kinds of horror, he thought, but somehow, even with her blouse filthy, her blonde hair hanging lank and greasy, her face smudged, she looked beautiful. When he raised his gaze, he could see across the plaza, across the buildings at the far end, clear out to the ocean, the too placid ocean. Birthday. Thanksgiving. Poof. And a showdown with Cain. Not to mention just daily life if they somehow all survived. Not to mention finding a way to escape or end the phase. And all he wanted to do was take Astrid's hand and lead her down to the beach, stretch a blanket out on the hot sand, lie down beside her, and sleep for about a month.
Right after the big Thanksgiving dinner, Sam promised himself. Right after the pie. 37. 79 hours, 0 minutes. Cookie rolled over and stood up. His legs were still weak and shaky. He had to hold himself up by leaning on the table. But he steadied himself with the arm that had been utterly shattered. Dara Beidou was there, and Elwood, both staring like they were witnessing a miracle.
I suppose they are,
Lana said to herself.
It doesn't hurt,
Cookie said. He laughed. It was an incredulous, disbelieving sound. He rotated his arm, all the way forward, all the way up. He squeezed his fingers into a fist.
It doesn't hurt.
Okay, I never thought I'd see that, Elwood said, shaking his head slowly. Tears came to Cookie's bloodshot eyes. He whispered to himself,
It doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt at all.
He took a tentative step, then another. He had lost a lot of weight. He was pale, and more than pale, almost green. He was shaky, a bear walking on its hind legs and about to topple over. He looked like what he was, a kid who'd taken a round trip to hell.
Thank you,
he whispered to Lana.
Thank you.
It's not my doing,
Lana said.
It's just, I don't know what it is.
She was tired. Healing Cookie had taken a long time. She'd been in the hospital since 8 o'clock that morning, having been awakened by Cookie's cries of agony. His injury was even worse than her own broken arm had been. It had taken her more than 6 hours, and now whatever benefit she'd gained from sleeping in the park was wasted, and she was weary again. Outside, she was pretty sure the sun was shining, but all she wanted now was a bed.
It's a thing I can do,
Lana said, fighting a yawn and stretching to get the kinks out of her back.
Just a thing.
Cookie nodded. Then, he did something no one expected. He got down on his knees before a shocked Dara.
You took care of me.
Dara shrugged and looked mightily uncomfortable.
It's okay, Cookie. No.
He took her hand awkwardly and leaned his forehead into her.
Anything you ever want. Anything. Anytime. Ever.
Tears choked his voice.
Anything.
Dara pulled him back to his feet. He had been as big and as heavy as Ork. He was still big enough to tower over Dara.
You need to start eating,
she said.
Yeah, eat,
Cookie said.
Then what do I do?
Dara looked a little exasperated. She said,
I don't know, Cookie.
Lana had an idea.
Go find Sam. There's a fight coming.
I can fight,
Cookie confirmed.
As soon as I get some food down and, you know, kind of get my strength back. McDonald's is open,
Dara said.
Try the French toast burger. It's better than it sounds.
Cookie left. Dara said,
Lana, I know it's mostly about Cookie, but I feel like you saved my life, too. I've been losing my mind taking care of him.
Lana was uncomfortable with gratitude. She always had been, even in small things.
Now, the idea that people were thanking her for performing near miracles, that was preposterous. She said,
"Do you know any place I could sleep? Like, in a bed?"
Elwood guided her and Patrick to his house. It was half a mile from the plaza, and Lana was practically sleepwalking by the time they reached it.
"Come on in," Elwood said. "You want something to eat?"
Lana shook her head.
"Just a place to... that couch."
"You could use one of the bedrooms upstairs."
Lana was already face down on the couch, and a split second later, she was asleep. Night had fallen by the time she woke. It took a while to figure out where she was. Elwood had thoughtfully fed Patrick. There was a clean-licked plate on the kitchen tile. Patrick was curled up before a gas fireplace, though there was no fire. Lana was ravenously hungry. She searched the kitchen, feeling like a burglar. The refrigerator had been emptied of everything but lemon juice, soy sauce, a carton of very expired half-and-half, and some very, very old lettuce. The freezer was better. There were frozen buffalo wings, something in a Tupperware container, and a microwavable pepperoni pizza.
"Oh, yes," Lana said. "Oh, definitely."
She popped the pizza in the microwave and punched the numbers. It was fascinating watching it rotate. Her mouth watered. It was all she could do to wait till the microwave dinged. She ate the pizza by ripping it with her bare hands, folding up the gooey slices and scooping up whatever dripped on the counter.
"Oh, you want some too?"
she asked, when Patrick showed up, wagging his tail and looking eager. She tossed him a piece, which he caught in the air.
"Well, we've been through it, huh, boy?"
Lana found the master bedroom shower upstairs and spent half an hour in the stream of hot water. The water ran red and black down the drain. Then she invited Patrick in, shampooed him up, rinsed him off, and kicked him out to shake like crazy and spray dog water all over the bathroom. She wrapped herself in a towel and went exploring through the house for clothing. Elwood didn't seem to have any sisters, but his mother was petite, so with some cinching and tying off, Lana managed to put together an outfit. She picked her old clothes up and almost fainted from the stench.
"Oh my God, Patrick, that's what I've been smelling like? I have to burn these things."
But she contented herself with stuffing the blood-stained, dirt-crusted, sweat-stinking, torn and shredded clothing into a trash bag. Unfortunately, she was stuck with her old shoes. Elwood's mother's shoes were two sizes too large. She trotted down the stairs, feeling better than she had in a very long time. Then she spotted the phone and could not resist the urge to pick it up. Call her mom. Tell her mom, well, something. She knew what everyone had told her about the phase, but still.
"No dial tone, Patrick."
Patrick was not interested.
"You know what, Patrick? I'm just gonna sit down and cry for a while."
But the tears wouldn't come. So after a while, she sighed and carried a warm Diet Pepsi out onto the porch. It was the middle of the night. The street was quiet. She was in a town she had grown up in, but had been away from for years. She'd run into some kids she'd known back in the day, but most of them hadn't recognized her beneath her coating of filth. Now maybe at least people would know her, although It occurred to her that Sam and Astrid and Adelio probably wouldn't recognize her now that she was clean.
"I feel like going somewhere, Patrick,"
she said,
"but I don't know where."
A car turned onto the street. It was moving slowly. Whoever was behind the wheel was clearly not an experienced driver. Lana stiffened, preparing to rush back inside and lock the door. She raised a cautious wave, but she couldn't see the driver, and the driver didn't seem to want to stop and chat. The car continued on down the street and turned off.
"Some kind of patrol,"
Lana said to Patrick. She stayed a while longer on the porch before heading back inside. She instantly recognized the boy standing in the kitchen. Patrick growled and raised his hackles.
"Hello, freak," Drake said.
Lana backed away, but too late. Drake leveled his gun at her.
"I'm right-handed. At least I used to be. But I can still hit you from this distance."
"What do you want?"
Drake motioned toward the stump of his right arm. It was gone from just above the elbow.
"What do you think I want?"
The one time she'd seen Drake Merwin, he had made her think of Pack Leader. Strong, hyper-alert, dangerous. Now, the lean physique looked gaunt. The shark's grin was a tight grimace. His eyes were red-rimmed. His stare, once languidly menacing, was now intense, burning hot. He looked like someone who had been tortured beyond endurance.
"I'll try,"
Lana said.
"You'll do more than try,"
he said. He convulsed in pain, face scrunched. A low, eerie moan escaped his throat.
"I don't know if I can grow a whole arm back,"
Lana said.
"Let me touch it."
"Not here,"
he hissed. He motioned with his gun.
"Through the back door."
"If you shoot me, I can't help you,"
Lana argued.
"Can you heal dogs? How about if I blow his brains out? Can you heal that freak?"
The car Lana had seen driving by was parked, engine running, in the alley behind the house. The boy called Panda was at the wheel.
"Don't make me do this,"
Lana pleaded.
"I would help you no matter what. You don't have to do this."
But there was no point in arguing. If Drake had ever owned a conscience, it had died along with his arm. They drove off through the sleeping town, out into the night. Howard had seen with his own eyes the small army Sam had assembled. He'd seen them descending on Ralph's. The grocery store was unguarded, which meant the other sheriffs had decided to get out of the way and make themselves scarce.
"There's too many,"
Howard had concluded. So he and Ork had stolen a car and made their way toward Coates Academy. But they had taken a wrong turn somewhere along the road and ended up on a dirt track leading into the desert as night fell. They had turned around, retracing their way to the main road, but that hadn't worked either. Finally, they ran out of gas.
"This was your stupid idea,"
Ork muttered.
"What did you want to do? Stay in town with Sam? He had like 20 kids with him."
"I could kick his butt."
"Ork, don't be a moron," Howard snapped in frustration. "If Kane's not there, and Drake's not there, and Sammy is marching back into town like a big deal, what do you think that means? I mean, come on, Ork, do the math."
Ork's pig eyes had narrowed to slits.
"Don't call me stupid. If I have to, I'll kick your teeth in."
Howard wasted 20 minutes ameliorating Ork's hurt feelings, which still left them sitting in a dead car in the middle of nowhere.
I see a light,
Ork said.
Hey! Yeah!
Howard jumped from the car and started running. Ork lumbered after him. The twin beams of a car moved at an intercept angle to them. If they slowed down, the car would miss them, never see them.
Hurry up!
Howard yelled.
Catch them!
Ork urged Howard on as he gave up the race and slowed to a heavy-footed slog.
Okay!
Howard yelled. His foot caught on something, and he sprawled into the dirt. He picked himself up, and only then felt the sharp pain in his ankle.
What the...
He froze. There was something there in the darkness. Not Ork. Something that smelled rank and panted like a dog. Howard was up and running in a heartbeat.
Something is after me!
He yelled. The car lights were vectoring toward him. He could make it. He could make it. If he didn't fall again. If the monster didn't get him first. Howard's feet hit blacktop, and he was illuminated, brilliant white. The car screeched. It came to a stop. The monster was nowhere in sight.
Howard?
Howard recognized the voice. Panda was leaning out of the window.
Panda? Man, am I glad to see you. We've been...
Something dark and swift leapt and caught Panda's arm. He let out a shriek. From inside the car, a dog barked frantically. Something hit Howard in the back, and he hit the pavement on his hands and knees. The car lurched forward. The bumper stopped 6 inches from Howard's head. There came a scream. A male voice. Ork. Ork, back in the darkness somewhere. There were dogs everywhere, swarming around Howard. No, not dogs, he thought. Wolves. Coyotes. The car door opened, and Panda fell out, wrapped half around a coyote. A loud bang and a stab of orange light. But the coyotes didn't stop. Another shot, and one of the coyotes yelped in pain. Drake staggered into view, looking like a scarecrow in the headlights. The coyotes retreated, out of the light, but by no means gone. Howard got slowly to his feet. Drake pointed the gun at Howard's face.
Did you set these dogs on me?
They'd shoot on me too, man!
Howard protested. Then he yelled out at the desert.
Ork! Ork, man! Ork!
A voice like wet gravel, but with an eerie, high-pitched tone, said,
Give us female.
Howard peered into the night, trying to make sense of it. It wasn't Ork. Where was Ork?
What female?
Drake demanded.
Who are you?
Slowly, on every side, all around the car, the desert moved. Shadows crept closer. Howard shrank back, but Drake stood firm.
Who's out there?
Drake demanded. A mange-eaten coyote with a scarred muzzle that gave him a sinister grin stepped into the circle of light. Howard almost fell down when he realized it was this coyote who spoke.
Give us female.
No,
Drake said, recovering quickly from the shock.
She's mine. I need her to heal my arm. She has the power, and I want my arm back.
You are nothing,
the coyote snarled.
I'm the kid with the gun,
Drake said.
The two of them, two of a kind, it seemed to Howard, stared holes in each other.
"What do you want with her?"
Drake demanded.
"Darkness say, bring female."
"Darkness? What's that supposed to mean?"
"Give us female,"
Pack Leader said, returning to his single-minded point.
"Or we kill all."
"I'll kill plenty of you."
"You die,"
Pack Leader said stubbornly. Howard felt it was time to speak up.
"Guys, guys, we have a standoff here. So why don't we see if we can figure out an arrangement?"
"What are you talking about?"
"Okay, look, Drake, you said something about the female healing your arm."
"She has the power. I want my arm back."
"And Mr., Coyote, you're supposed to take her to some other dog called Darkness?"
Pack Leader eyed Howard in a way that suggested he was considering how to butcher and eat him.
"Okay,"
Howard said shakily.
"I think we can work a deal."
38. 74 hours, 10 minutes. "Astrid," Adelio said, "I'm so sorry about your house." Astrid squeezed Adelio's hand.
"Yeah. I have to admit, it was hard for me to see."
"You could stay over at the firehouse with me and Sam and Quinn," Adelio offered.
"It's okay. Petey and I are going to room with Mother Mary and Brother John for a while. They're hardly ever home. And when they are, well, you know, it's good to have people around."
The three of them, Adelio, Astrid, and Little Pete, were in the office that had once belonged to the mayor of Perdido Beach, and most recently had been occupied by Kane Soren. Sam had resisted the idea of taking the office, feeling it made him seem self-important, but Astrid had argued that symbols were important, and kids wanted to think that someone was in charge. She settled Little Pete into a chair and handed him a baggie full of rice Chex. Little Pete liked to eat them plain, no milk.
"Where's Sam?" Astrid asked. "And why are we here?"
Adelio looked uncomfortable.
"We have something to show you."
Sam opened the door. He did not smile at Astrid. He looked warily at Little Pete. He said hello, then,
"Astrid, there's something you need to see.
And I'm thinking Little Pete shouldn't see."
"I don't understand."
Sam flopped into the chair last occupied by Kane. Astrid was struck by how alike the two boys looked superficially, and by how different a reaction she had to their similar features. Where Kane hid his arrogance and cruelty beneath a smooth, controlled surface, Sam let his emotions play out on his face. Right now, he was sad and weary and concerned.
"I wonder if LP could sit with Adelio in the other room." "That sounds ominous,"
Astrid said. The expression on Sam's face did not contradict her. She managed to get Little Pete to move, though not without a struggle. Adelio stayed with him. Sam had a DVD in his hand. He said, "Yesterday I sent Adelio to the power plant to get two things. First, a cache of automatic weapons from the guardhouse."
"Machine guns?"
"Yeah. Not just for us to have, but to make sure the other side doesn't get them."
"Now we have an arms race,"
Astrid said. Her tone seemed to irritate Sam. "You want me to leave them for Kane?"
"I wasn't criticizing, just, you know, ninth graders with machine guns. It's hard to make that a happy story."
Sam relented. He even grinned. The phrase ninth graders with machine guns isn't exactly followed by have a nice day.
No wonder you looked so grim.
As soon as she said it, she knew she was wrong. He had something else to tell her. Something worse. The DVD. I've been wondering, like you, why the phase seems to be centered on the power plant. 10 miles in every direction. Why? So Adelio went through some of the security video at the plant. Astrid stood up so suddenly she surprised herself.
I really shouldn't leave Petey alone.
You know what this DVD will show, don't you? It wasn't a question. You guessed it that first night. I remember we were looking at the video map. You put your arm around little Pete, and you gave me a very weird look. At the time, I didn't know what to make of that look.
I didn't know you then,
Astrid said.
I didn't know if I could trust you.
Sam slid the DVD into the player and switched on the TV. The sound quality is pretty bad. Astrid saw the control room of the power plant from a high vantage point with a wide angle. The camera showed the control room. 5 adults, 3 men and 2 women. One of them was Astrid's father. The image brought a lump to her throat. There he was, her father, rocking in his chair, joking with the woman at the next station, leaning forward to fill out some paperwork. And sitting in a chair against the far wall, his face lit by the glow of his omnipresent Game Boy, was little Pete. The only sound was muddy, unintelligible conversation. "Here it comes," Sam said. Suddenly, a klaxon sounded, harsh and distorted on the audio. Everyone in the control room jumped. People rushed to the monitors, to the instrument readouts. Astrid's father shot a worried glance at his son, but then leaned into his monitor, staring. Other people swept into the room and moved with practiced efficiency to the untended monitors. Panicky instructions were shouted back and forth. A second alarm went off, more shrill than the first. A strobe warning light was flashing, fear on every face. And little Pete was rocking frantically, his hands pressed over his ears. He had a look of pain on his innocent face. The 10 adults now in the room were a terrifying pantomime of controlled desperation. Keyboards were punched, switches thrown. Her father grabbed a thick manual and began snapping through the pages, and all the while people shouted and the alarms blared and little Pete was screaming, screaming, hands over his ears. "I don't want to see this," Astrid said, but she couldn't look away. Little Pete jumped to his feet. He ran to his father, but his father, frantic, pushed him away. Little Pete went sprawling against a chair. He ended up flung against the long table, staring at a monitor that flashed, flashed, flashed a warning in bright red. The number 14.
Code 14,
Astrid said dully.
I heard my dad say that one time. It's the code for a core meltdown. He would make a joke out of it. Code 11, that was minor trouble. Code 12, you worry. Code 13, you call the governor. Code 14, you pray. The next stage, code 15, is obliteration.
On the tape, little Pete pulled his hands from his ears. The klaxon was relentless. There was a flash that blanked out the tape. Several seconds of static. When the picture stabilized, the warning alarm was silent, and little Pete was alone. Astrid, you'll notice that the time signature on the tape says November 10th, 10:18 a.m. The exact time when every person over the age of 14 disappeared. On the tape, little Pete stopped crying. He didn't even look around. He just walked back to the chair where he had been sitting, retrieved his game, and resumed play. Little Pete caused the phase, Sam said flatly. Astrid covered her face with her hands. She was surprised by the tears she felt rising and their force. She struggled to keep from sobbing. It was a few minutes before she could speak. Sam waited patiently.
"He didn't know he was doing it,"
Astrid said in a low, unsteady voice.
"He doesn't know what he's doing. Not the way we do. Not like, if I do this, then that will happen."
"I know that."
"You can't blame him."
Astrid looked up, eyes blazing defiantly. "Blame him?" Sam moved to sit beside her on the couch, close enough that their legs were touching. "Astrid, I can't believe I'm saying this to you, but I think you overlooked something." She turned her tear-stained face to him, searching. "Astrid, they were having a meltdown. They didn't seem to be getting it under control. They all looked pretty scared." Astrid gasped. Sam was right. She had missed it.
"He stopped the meltdown. A meltdown might have killed everyone in Perdido Beach."
"Yeah. I'm not crazy about the way he did it, but he may have saved everyone's life."
"He stopped the meltdown,"
Astrid said, still not grasping it fully. Sam grinned. He even laughed.
"What's funny?"
she demanded. "I figured something out before Astrid the Genius. I am totally enjoying that. I'm just going to gloat here for a minute."
"Enjoy it. It may never happen again,"
Astrid said. "Oh, believe me, I know that." He took her hand, and she was very glad to feel his touch. "He saved us. But he also created this whole weird thing."
"Not the whole thing,"
Astrid said, shaking her head.
"The mutations prefigure the phase. Indeed, the mutations were the sine qua non of the phase, the thing without which the phase could not have occurred."
Sam refused to be impressed. "You can hammer me all you want with your indeeds and your prefigures and your sine qua nons. I am still gloating here." She raised his hand to her lips and kissed his fingers. Then she released him, stood up, paced across the room and back, stopped, and said,
"Diana, she talks about it being like cell phone bars. 2 bars, 3 bars. Kane is a 4 bar. You are too, I would guess. Petey, I guess he's a 5 or a 7.
"Or a 10, Sam agreed.
"But Diana thinks it's like reception. Like some of us can get better reception. If that's true, then we aren't generating the power, just using it, focusing it."
"So?"
"So where's it coming from? To extend the analogy, where's the cell phone tower? What is generating the power?"
Sam rose with a sigh. "One thing for sure. This never gets out. Edilio knows, I know, and you know. No one else can ever know." Astrid nodded.
"People would hate him, or try to use him."
Sam nodded.
"I wish..." "No,"
Astrid said, and shrugged helplessly.
"There's no way to get him to undo it."
"That's a pity," Sam said, making a wry smile that did not reach his eyes. "Because tick-tock, tick-tock."
Lana stumbled through the night. Back with the coyotes. A nightmare revisited. And now, adding to the misery, Drake and Howard stumbled along with her. Drake with his gun. Drake cursing his pain. And Howard calling, "Ork! Ork!" into the night. Greater than any misery, the dread of that mineshaft and what lay at the bottom. She had disobeyed the darkness. What would the seething monster do to her?
"Let's stop and I'll try to fix Drake's arm, okay?"
she pleaded.
"No stop,"
Pack Leader snarled.
"Let me try at least."
Pack Leader ignored her, and they ran and tripped and picked themselves up and ran some more. No escape now. No possibility of escape. Unless... She maneuvered closer to Drake.
"What if he won't let me heal you?"
"Don't try to play me," Drake said tersely. "Anyway, now I want to see this thing that has you so terrified."
"No, you don't,"
Lana promised.
"What is it?"
Howard asked, nervous, almost as scared as Lana herself. Lana had no answer to that question. Each step was harder than the one before, and several times Pack Leader nipped at her to move her along. When he didn't, Drake did, waving his gun at her, threatening her with word and gesture and look. They reached the abandoned mining camp after the moon had set, and as the stars were just fading before the promise of dawn. She had never felt such dread. It was as if her blood had all been drained and replaced with a cold sludge. She could barely move. Her heart beat in loud, shuddering thumps in her chest. She wanted to pet Patrick, to take some tiny measure of comfort from him. But she couldn't make herself bend, couldn't bring herself to speak. She held herself tightly contained, silent, rigid. "I'm going to die here," Lana thought.
"Human light,"
Pack Leader slurred. He indicated a flashlight lying wedged between the rocks. Howard leapt at it and switched it on. His hand shook so badly, the light danced across rock walls, sending shadows flying like swift-moving ghosts. Now even Drake seemed leery, frightened of something he couldn't quite explain. He was asking questions, ever more agitated as they stepped into the icebox chill of the mine.
"Someone needs to tell me what we're gonna see," Drake insisted.
"I need to know what we're up to," Drake said.
"Maybe we better talk about our deal," Drake said.
"How much farther?"
Drake said. But all the while, they moved down the shaft. Lana had to force each breath, had to remind herself, "Breathe, breathe." Patrick was gone. He'd abandoned them at the mouth of the mine.
"Man, I can't do this,"
Howard said. He was gasping for breath.
"Shut up,"
Drake snapped, glad to have someone to take out his frustrations on. Howard turned suddenly and bolted, taking the flashlight with him. Pack Leader yipped a command, and two coyotes went in pursuit. With the flashlight gone, Lana could see the faint green glow from the walls. Darkness behind. The darkness ahead.
"Let him go," Drake said.
"Howard's not important,"
Drake said.
"I'm important,"
Drake said. His voice was small. Lana closed her eyes tight, but somehow the green glow penetrated her eyelids, as though it could shine right through her flesh, right through the bone of her skull. She could go no farther. She sank to her knees. Close enough. It was there. Just ahead. Just around that last bend. A moving, sliding, grinding pile of glowing rock. The soundless voice was a cudgel slamming her head. The darkness thrust invisible fingers of ice into her mind, and Lana knew that she herself was speaking its words.
"The healer,"
she cried in a tortured, manic parody of her own voice. She kept her eyes shut, but could feel Drake kneeling beside her.
"Why do you come to me?"
Lana cried. A puppet, nothing but a tool for the darkness to use.
"The coyote,"
Drake managed.
"Faithful pack leader,"
the darkness said through Lana.
"Obedient, but not yet equal to a human."
"Open your eyes," Lana told herself. "Be brave. Be brave. See it. Face it. Fight it." But the darkness was in her skull, pushing and prodding, peeking inside her secrets, laughing at her pathetic resistance. And yet she opened her eyes. A lifelong habit of defiance gave her the strength, but she kept her eyes cast down, strong enough to force them open, too terrified to look on the face of the thing itself. The rocks under her knees glowed. She was touching it, touching the hem of it. Pack leader groveled, lowering himself to the floor of the cave beside Lana, crawling on his belly. Suddenly, Lana felt an electric shock of terrifying force. Her back arched, her head went back, her arms flew wide. A pain like an icicle stabbing her eye and searing her brain. She tried to scream, but no sound would come out. Then it was gone, and she fell onto her back, legs folded beneath her. She gasped like a landed fish, unable to fill her lungs.
"Defiance,"
she croaked in a voice not her own.
"She's supposed to fix my arm," Drake said. "If you kill her, she can't help me."
"You are bold to make demands,"
the darkness said through Lana.
"I'm not. It's... I want my arm back,"
Drake shouted raggedly. Lana found she could breathe again. She sucked in oxygen. She pushed out against the floor, scooted inch by inch away from the darkness. Drake shrieked in agony. Lana saw him as she had been, like he'd grabbed a power line. His body jerked like a marionette. The darkness released him.
"Ah,"
the darkness said, and twisted Lana's mouth into a rictus.
"I have found a much better teacher for you, pack leader."
Pack leader had dared to stand up. He kept his tail and head aligned in a submissive posture. He glanced at Drake, who had now been released and was doubled over, clutching his arm in pain.
"This human will teach you to kill humans,"
Lana said. Drake spoke as though each syllable was an effort.
"Yes, but my arm..."
"Give me the arm,"
Lana said, and, unwilling, crawled to Drake. Drake stood up, shaky but determined. He extended the burned, sawed-off stump.
"I will give you an arm such as no human ever had,"
the darkness said through Lana.
You have no magic within you, human, but the girl will serve.